Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace, episode number 200.
Yay!
The podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. Here for the 200th time is me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo, and happy 200th?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you. But it's funny when you say, like, for the 200th time, it sounds like you're annoyed at something, you know, when you say, oh, I've told you for the 200th time.
Rambo, I've told you for the 200th time that this podcast is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. Come on, why won't you get it?
Well, I'm going to be annoying and tell you that that hasn't been the tagline since the beginning. So it hasn't been 200 times.
You're right. That joke completely fell through, right? Oh, typical. What a good start of this 200th episode. Well, it's been an exciting times. There we have, of course, WWDC was a little while ago. There's a lot of people now experimenting with the new technologies, Vision OS and so on and so forth. But I think we're going to talk about slightly different things on this episode. I know that we've been teasing that we're going to share more about our kind of first impressions of the new SDKs and so on. And that will probably also happen, maybe happen during this episode. But I think that's something still that we might do for our episode during the next month, during August, where we will have had a little bit more time still, like really experimenting with the new technologies. I've started to adopt, of course, like iOS 17 in the projects I work on, making sure they all, you know, work and compile and run well on Apple's new operating system. But I must say that still, like, I still have that deep dive I really want to do, really checking out a lot of the new technologies, because like now that I'm working mostly as a freelancer and I'm kind of just like working on projects and actually like maintaining apps and shipping features, I don't have that same kind of lot of time to dive into the new technologies as I used to, where I'm more focused on shipping things that I can with technologies I can use today, which of course does not include iOS 17 for the projects I work on because they are backward compatible. But I don't know how it's been like for you this summer. Have you, or winter for you? How has it been? How have you been able to kind of use some of the new technologies? I know that you have, of course, been updating AirBuddy and so on. So what's that kind of situation been like for you?
Yeah, it's funny. This year, I've done something that I don't do very often, which I shipped an update to AirBuddy, which is version 2.7. I think it was last week. And it actually includes a little fix for macOS Sonoma, which was like a fairly major issue that happens with the app running in Sonoma, but it's usually not something I do. I usually wait for the OS to go out, but it was such a simple fix. It was one of those one-liners, like I was calling an API in macOS Sonoma and I should call another one, and that was it. So I thought, and I had other things to address in the app, some minor bug fixes and things like that. So I just decided to, well, I'm just going to release this little fix in there, and very carefully note in the release notes that even though this is a little fix for macOS Sonoma for people who are living on beta, the app does not support macOS Sonoma just yet, but it kind of gives me a little more peace of mind that I can keep working on the next major version and not worry about, oh, there's a bunch of people in macOS Sonoma who are using a broken app. So I think I'm happy about that. But in general, my focus on new APIs and things like that has been on the new widgets and app intents stuff. So I've been doing a lot of that, especially reviewing, not really, I don't know the words, because I say I'm reviewing because I had watched the presentations about app intents last year, but I hadn't actually used them yet. So it's kind of like reviewing, but actually viewing for the first time with the intent. You see what I did there?
Right.
With the intent to actually use the API. So yeah, I've been diving into app intents and the new interactive widgets and things like that. So that's been fun and complicated as well, because it's one of those system features where it's very easy to break things and you have to figure out what's going on, and it's sometimes a bit cumbersome to figure out, but I think I'm getting the hang of it.
How does that kind of debugging process look like when you're implementing an app intent? Like I'm assuming you have to kind of first build and run the app, get the app to kind of broadcast those intents again, maybe delete some caches or something, and then go to the shortcuts app or something? Like, how do you actually test that code when you're working on it?
Well, that got a lot better with the SDK this year and the simulator and Xcode and all of that stuff, because, for instance, if you are developing an interactive widget for iOS 17, you can just build and run your actual widget target from within Xcode, and you will place a widget in the home screen and run it and debug the process. So you get all the logs, all the, like, you can set breakpoints, you can do everything you want. So that's been really handy. And there's even like a new section in the scheme settings for widget targets where you can actually tell it, hey, when I build and run, I want you to put a widget of this kind with this family, and I want the timeline or I want the snapshot or whatever. So that's been really handy. The thing with the app intents is it took me a while to understand how they work. And I'm one of those, maybe I shouldn't, maybe that's the problem, that I want to understand how they work. But I'm one of those developers who likes to know how things work and what's happening. And it's interesting how they've kind of abstracted the process, basically. So you can define an app intent in your widget target, and it will run in your widget extension process, and you don't need to worry about whether it's running in there or in your app or in an intent extension. And that got me a bit confused, because I was using intents for my widgets, and those were also showing up in the shortcuts app.
Right.
And I was like, all right, so they're showing up in the shortcuts app, but when I run the intent, what's it doing? Like, is it running my widget and doing the intent in there? And that's actually what was happening. So I was thinking about, how can I make this a bit more like organized? Because I don't want to have a little bit of intents in my app and a little bit in an intents extension and a little bit in the widgets, and I don't know which process is running them and what entitlements the process has. So that was a bit weird to get the hang of, but I think I figured it out. And with the SDKs this year, you can actually have all of your intents in a framework that you embed in your app, and the framework can then export those intents to the rest of your extensions or the app itself. So I am thinking of doing something like that for interactive widgets. So once you get the hang of it, I think I like it. It's actually really nice, but it's kind of an uphill battle at the start, at least, because also, like, there's very complicated property wrapper stuff and some return values going on where the autocomplete doesn't really help you in Xcode. It doesn't really give you a good example of what the right syntax would be. So it looks way more complicated than it actually is. But once you know the syntax and you see a few examples, it's actually really nice.
Yeah, it's one of those things we've talked about, I think, in the past, which is that since they reuse the intent system for many different kind of extensions and ways to interact with the system, including how you interact with the personal assistant, including how you interact with shortcuts and now widgets as well, and kind of building on top of that. And we've been joking that, you know, it's almost like the NS user activity operating system at this point, right? Like, it's it's kind of that connection point that exists between so many different features that you interact with. And that is good from one perspective, in that you can probably reuse some code. And once you've learned that system, you can kind of apply it in multiple places. Like, there's a lot of advantages to that. And of course, also on the system level, they probably have I haven't seen the source code, but I can imagine that the kind of way that intents are handled across the system can also probably be shared by Apple, like internally when they implement these things, which can lead to more robust code and fewer bugs and so on. And that is, you know, beneficial for us as well. But the downside then is kind of what you've also mentioned there, which is that it can get a little bit confusing when you have all these different intents and they kind of fulfill or they fill different roles in your application. Like, one is just there to drive a widget where another one is there to kind of facilitate shortcuts integration or personal assistant integration. And that can also be a little bit confusing when the same kind of API is used for very, very different things.
Yeah, and I was also a bit confused about what would happen with my existing intents. So say I'm working in an app that already includes the old style intents, where you had to create an intent definition file and all of that stuff, which, by the way, you don't have to anymore. And that's my favorite part about the new app intent system, because I'm really not a fan of all of those configuration files and things like that. And I guess Apple isn't as well, because they've been eliminating them now with Swift Data as well. You don't have to create a core data model with the model editor. You didn't have to before, but anyway, most people did.
Yeah, but it's kind of like you can build your UI programmatically entirely on macOS, but you know, building your main menu, for example, not in a storyboard file before, that was like very, very cumbersome, right? You were definitely encouraged by the system to use the editor for many of these things.
Yeah, exactly. So I like the way they're doing things now with less configuration files. And what happens when you build the app intents is there's a little metadata extractor, and you will bundle with your app a little metadata bundle where the system can know about the types and where they are and what they are, so that it can build all of the dynamic UI that you can use to configure your intents and things like that. So I really liked the new approach, but I was really confused about what happens with my existing intents. And they've actually handled it quite well, in my opinion. I created like a little separate project where I tried to simulate as best as possible an app that was created before iOS 17, so using like the previous SDK, and added like a few widgets and intents, and then opened it up in the new Xcode and added app intents and widgets that use the app intents, and the system handles that fairly well, unless you have like exactly the same things duplicated, which you definitely shouldn't. And there is a migration path between the old way and the new way that you can use if you want to. So it will actually take your intent definition file and create Swift code for you based on that. And then it will just work, famous last words. in general, you can mix and match. And my current plan, at least with AirBuddy, which is where I plan on adopting a lot of this stuff, is to have the old intents still in there so that people on previous operating systems can still use them. And those that already exist in that model will continue to be using that old model and be maintained in that way. But new intents and new widgets going forward, I'll use the new system instead. I think that's a good way to handle it and still support old operating systems without breaking.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, really good approach. And that, I would say, is generally the approach I take as well when it comes to these sorts of things, is that there's a very, very strong desire sometimes to go back and change the existing things and like have everything in one system, because, of course, now you have intents, both some in configuration files and some using the new API in code. And, you know, over time, that could become a little bit complicated to maintain, or sometimes you might forget that, you know, there's one intent here and one intent there, and then that could lead to bugs and so on. So when you have things spread out, there's definitely kind of a downside or like a maintenance burden to that. But that desire to kind of go back and rewrite existing things, we've talked about it before, that there are so many downsides to that as well, where, you know, if you just leave something that is working, and especially when it's there for backward compatibility, even if it might feel a bit like, you know, this corner of the app that you really want to clean up, that like dirty corner, to just kind of leave it there and let that be, because then, you know, users can get that backward compatibility. And also, like, you're not accidentally breaking something just for the sake of kind of making it look nicer when you're working with it. So yeah. I also tend to take that approach. Like, if you have some kind of legacy component that is this there for backward compatibility, just kind of leave that alone for now, especially if it's not problematic and it's not broken or has a ton of bugs. And then you kind of just build on the new things. And then eventually, time will run its course and that legacy support might not be needed anymore. And then you can just go ahead and delete it, right? So that I would say is probably a good approach to take in situations like this.
Yeah, and intents are a good candidate for that, because at least in most cases, and definitely the case for most of my apps, all they're doing is leveraging existing functionality in your app. So it's basically just calling into your own stuff that's already there. So it's not really a lot of code. It's basically just boilerplate. And then the like the core of it, which is the handle method on the intent, is just calling into something, manipulating the inputs and calling something in your app and manipulating the output, and that's it. So it's not like a huge amount of code that will break in terrible ways if you refactor something or something like that.
Right, exactly. But I do really love what you mentioned there, that Apple is kind of seemingly has a pretty concrete strategy to move away from configuration files and have everything be defined using different kind of DSLs or different APIs in code. And of course, one of the earlier examples we saw of this was SwiftUI, where it was like, before, there was always this debate of, do you build your UI in code? Do you build it using storyboards or using just zip files? And like I mentioned earlier, for certain platforms like macOS, for certain things, there was definitely like a downside of doing one approach over the other. And, you know, you could argue for different situations, there could be, you know, an upside to doing it in code or a downside to doing it in code. But now with SwiftUI, it's pretty clear, like everything is just all in code. And even if you prefer to work visually, you have the previews to do that. And now that they're taking those steps also with intents, with core data, like you mentioned, with Swift data, that is also really great to see, I feel like, because that combination of like dynamically loaded configuration files that are sometimes code generated on the fly, or, you know, method implementations are generated on the fly, that was a really good fit for Objective-C, which was, you know, incredibly dynamic language and incredibly powerful because of that. But with Swift, we have this very different approach of wanting to make everything type safe and compiler validated and so on. And just having those dynamic configuration files was always just kind of in stark contrast to those goals. And it always felt like they were always colliding in the middle. When you're writing, for example, core data code with Swift, it's really sometimes very cumbersome when you have to like force unwrap things or write things in very specific ways, even though there are those kind of semi-property wrappers, which I guess are just kind of property wrappers before there were property wrappers, which is like at NS managed. They make life easier, but still you can really feel that clash when you're working with these configuration files against Swift as such a static, kind of type safe focused language, right?
Yeah.
So having everything be in code and having that code then generate resources, or having it be like, feel almost like writing a configuration file because of the different syntax you can achieve with Swift now, I think that is a really nice middle ground where you get all of the benefits of having everything be compiled, having like that single source of truth, but you still don't have to have like thousands of lines of boilerplate just to kind of set up your core data stack, right?
Right. And it's funny that whenever we talk about this, it kind of sounds like we are saying that Objective-C is terrible and Swift is awesome. But that's not actually the case. And when you think about it, both are fantastic for the trade-offs that they make, right? Because I really like Objective-C, and I think the runtime is incredible, and all the really cool stuff you can do with it, such as key value coding and things like that. Like core animation is a great example of key value coding working, because they do all of the implicit animations and things like that, and that's mostly based on key value coding. And old core data and storyboards and things like that, all of that stuff leveraged the Objective-C runtime to some extent. And then Swift makes other trade-offs where type safety is more important, so you get less of that dynamic runtime stuff, but you get all the benefits of type safety and things like that. So as we usually say here, it depends on what trade-offs you want to make.
Yeah, I think when you get into trouble, and this is true, I think, for not just for Objective-C and Swift, but it's kind of universal across different programming languages, is that when you try to use a language for either something that it wasn't designed for, or you're using patterns that were popular or useful in one language in a completely different language.
Right.
So that's what we're talking about here. Like using configuration files and that dynamic runtime, that was amazing in Objective-C, like really, really good fit. But it's not a good fit for Swift, because Swift makes other trade-offs, right? It's designed in a different way. And that's when you end up with that clash or that conflict where the language wants to go one way and want to enforce its goals. And then you have those configuration files kind of feeling like just add-ons, like not that same nice integration as you would get in Objective-C, right?
And then in Swift, everything is any optional and all of that terrible stuff.
Exactly. And then it just feels like a bad fit, right? And it's very similar, like when I remember back when I first learned Objective-C and I was starting to work on iOS apps, sometimes I would encounter code bases that were written by people who were mostly Java programmers. And you could really, really tell when they would use like Java programming patterns in Objective-C. And that again was such a clash because, you know, Java and Objective-C, very, very different languages, like very different syntaxes and so on. So that really, really stood out. And that's another one of those examples, like you're kind of bringing your way of coding, your API design ideas and so on to a completely different language and kind of just using them without really kind of considering what are the norms and standards and patterns that are used in this environment. And that's, I feel like, is always a consideration that is important to make. And I, like, when I'm now working sometimes with Ruby code or sometimes Python code or something, part of scripting or some tooling that I'm working with or something for a client project, I don't go in there and start writing code as if it was Swift, right? I think that's another recipe for disaster. It's like you want to definitely make sure to use the conventions that are appropriate for the language you're working with.
Yeah, who wants to write Python in Swift, right?
Exactly. I mean, there was that Python-Swift bridge, right? But that's a completely different thing when you're bridging things. That's a good thing, I think. Bridging technologies is great because then you can reuse things and create nice compatibility. But it's like when you're actually like taking those patterns and directly using them in the language, that's when it can become problematic.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So, Rambo, you were talking about App Intents, of course, and working with widgets. And speaking of widgets, I know that you've been working on another set of widgets. And Apple has also been working on the same sort of widgets. So that's a lot of widgets there going on. So tell me, what's going on here?
Yeah, so as we mentioned before, I've been developing this desktop widget system for AirBuddy on macOS for quite a while now. And Apple just came out with macOS Sonoma, the announcement, and one of the features is desktop widgets. So what am I going to do about that? and I think that's something many people have been asking about. And I think I came up with what's going to be my approach to that. And my main concern once I saw the announcement was how well Apple's system would work, and would I be able to adopt it for AirBuddy and have a good experience for users? Because the main reasoning behind the desktop widgets for AirBuddy is that WidgetKit on macOS has been a disaster since it was announced and released in Big Sur. It's always very unreliable. It breaks all the time without any changes to the app. Like a minor OS update comes out and it just deletes all your widgets, or the configuration doesn't work anymore. So me and my users, we had lots of issues with the WidgetKit system on macOS. But from my testing on macOS Sonoma so far, it's a lot better now. And I think the reason that happened is because the way WidgetKit used to work on macOS, or is working on macOS until Ventura, is they basically took the WidgetKit system from iOS and embedded it in the notification center process on macOS. And all of the work that's done by a bunch of system daemons and agents on iOS was all concentrated in the notification center process on macOS. And I'm pretty sure it was also using some Catalyst stuff behind the scenes, like the configuration UI was always Catalyst and stuff. So it was a bunch of technologies mixed into the spots of Notification Center, and it didn't really work very well. And as far as I've been able to tell on macOS Sonoma, they have actually done the work to properly integrate the whole Chrono system, which handles like the widget updates and things like that, into macOS. So the result is that they're a lot more reliable on macOS Sonoma, and you can now put your widgets on the desktop and they can have interaction. So from my initial testing, it looks like I'll be able to deliver the experience that I want for widgets in AirBuddy in macOS Sonoma using Apple's widget system. So that leaves the question, do I throw away my desktop widgets system, or what do I do about that? So my intention so far is to ship the widget system, so the custom one, for previous OS versions. So AirBuddy 3 will probably support Monterey and up. So for Monterey and Ventura, users will be able to place AirBuddy widgets on the desktop using my custom system. And for macOS Sonoma, I'll just not have that feature basically enabled for when running in macOS Sonoma, and users will be able to use the native system widgets to place AirBuddy widgets in the desktop. I think that's a good way to keep the feature around, because it was always going to be for basically all supported versions of macOS for version 3 of AirBuddy. So I don't want to take it out completely, because then people on Monterey and Ventura wouldn't be able to use them. But also, I don't want to have, and I actually have a prototype where my custom widget system will let you place widgets on the desktop in macOS Sonoma, and they will actually kind of lay out themselves in relation to the native widgets on the system. But I don't want to have to support that. And if the native system works and delivers like 95% of the experience that I want, I decided to just go with that for macOS Sonoma.
That sounds really interesting. So my first question would be, when a user upgrades then from, let's say, Ventura to Sonoma, will their widget configurations carry over? Because effectively then they will be moving from your custom system to the system, the built-in system. Will those configurations kind of also move across then, or will they have to set up their widgets from the beginning?
Yeah, I am thinking about that still, but I did find a plist file in macOS Sonoma that I could probably write to and make the current configuration appear as native widgets. But I think that's a bit scary to mess with that stuff, and it will probably break with OS updates and things like that. So my current idea is to just have like a little onboarding pop-up. Hey, by the way, your widgets now can be placed on the desktop using the native system. And for reference, here are the widgets you previously had, because there aren't that many AirBuddy widgets, and the widgets that are there, the configuration is not that complicated. So it's not like people are going to spend 2 hours setting up their widgets. It's like a 5-minute thing. So I don't think it's a huge deal for the widgets to go away and have to be reconfigured when they upgrade.
Okay, cool. And the next question here, now, and I'm just sending questions your way here, but this is very interesting to me, like, especially when we're talking about that plan of like having it specifically be a feature for older OSs is very interesting, because very often we tend to do the opposite, right?
Right.
We tend to build new features and we want to use new system features to power that. And because of that, we kind of gate it behind the latest OS. So you don't see the feature if you're not on iOS 16 or 17 or whatever the latest version might be that you're working against. But here you basically have the opposite. So if I remember correctly, the primary reason why you wanted to build this desktop widget system was because, like you mentioned, you were kind of annoyed at how WidgetKit was working on macOS, that it kind of inherited all of the drawbacks or kind of limitations of that implementation on iOS, where you're more constrained by, you know, system resources and battery and so on. And you had that also on macOS, so they wouldn't update frequently enough and so on. And you wanted your own widgets to basically be able to be reliable with the battery widgets and so on that you have in AirBuddy, but you also wanted to be able to place them on the desktop. But the question then is, like, do you still feel like this is a feature that actually really makes sense to be bundled into AirBuddy? And have you considered instead making it a standalone app or standalone plugin or something like that that actually runs those widgets?
I've done more than that. I've actually built a prototype of an app that did that, and I think I showed it to you. I'm still not sure about that. But the thing is, if I'm building a general desktop widgets app that's not AirBuddy itself, I would have to provide desktop widgets for things that are unrelated to what AirBuddy does, right? Because it would be a general desktop widgets app. I found a way, and you know that because I showed it to you. I found a way, but this was back in Monterey, I think, when I did this prototype. So I found a way to actually host WidgetKit widgets in this app that I made, this prototype.
Any widgets, not just your own widgets, but any widgets from the App Store, basically.
Right, exactly. I don't think that will work in Ventura, because I haven't tested, but it probably won't. And also, it's not something I would be comfortable shipping, because it's very hacky and very much like using all sorts of private API and even like using private Swift API. Like, I had to create Swift interface files and things like that in order to get it to link, basically, with system API. So basically, that would be a nightmare of an app to maintain. And AirBuddy itself is not easy because of all of the hardware stuff. So it's not a project I am willing to approach at the moment. I'll keep the limited scope with the AirBuddy widgets, which is, I think, more than enough. And then if at some point in the future I want to try out this idea again, then I'll look into it. Some other people I mentioned this project and showed it to, they mentioned like having some sort of API where other developers could make their own widgets. But I really don't feel like that would be a thing that would work, because it's already difficult for Apple to get developers to adopt their API. So imagine me, Rambo, a random developer, I want other developers to adopt my API, so I will have to like maintain the Rambo developer ecosystem alive and things like that.
You need to have a Rambo developer account.
Yeah, and maintain like an SDK for the Widget Buddy or whatever. And that's just not something I want to deal with. So let's leave that in the drawer, in the idea drawer for now, and maybe open it up at a future date.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, you do have the advantage when it comes to the maintenance aspect, that you know that you're not going to have to support new OS versions, because you know that, you know, once people upgrade to Sonoma, they're not using this app anymore. They're using the built-in system widgets, right?
Right.
But then, like you mentioned, on the other hand, like, you would also have to build out a lot of that infrastructure or provide SDK and so on. And, you know, it just becomes like a huge, huge project at that point. So, yeah, I completely understand why you don't want to go down that route. So keeping it within AirBuddy then sounds very, very good. And it is really cool. It's actually going to be very interesting to hear like what the response is going to be here from the users, because, again, you're specifically targeting users here who won't upgrade or can't upgrade or don't want to upgrade or whatever the situation is, but they're running older OS versions on their Mac, and this is specifically for those users. So that's going to be very interesting to see, you know, what kind of support does that generate? What kind of response does it generate from the community? Because usually when you get like featured on different websites and reviewers are checking it out and, you know, people are talking about it on social media and so on, I don't want to make assumptions, but I kind of think that those people are usually running the latest operating systems, right?
Right.
Like, if you're writing for The Verge or something, you're probably like mostly focused on the latest stuff. And here you're releasing a feature that is specifically for older OSs. So again, it's going to be really interesting to see like how this is going to be received by your users and, you know, how many people will use it and what it will be like for you, like actually shipping and maintaining this product.
Yeah. One thing that's important to note is that this doesn't mean that the whole widget system that I've been working so hard on will basically die once I can require macOS Sonoma, because there's a lot of code in what I wrote for the widget system that will be used by other parts of the app. So there are other places where these widgets can show up, and I don't want to reveal too much about that now, but what I want to say is these custom widgets, not WidgetKit widgets, will be used in macOS Sonoma, just not on the desktop.
All right. Where could they be used? That's interesting. Widgets on the lock screen. Widgets broadcasted from macOS Sonoma into Vision OS, ooh, making it Vision Body. Let's see what's going to happen.
Right. So that was a lot of intents and widgets and whatnot, but I want to know, what have you been up to?
So I'm continuing here the summer in my part of the world here. Just kind of keep working on the apps that I work on. It's been really, really nice, I feel like, this summer to just be able to focus on building out new features for clients and working on those apps. And I've been really kind of just focusing in on that. So I know I haven't been writing a lot of articles lately. I know I haven't been podcasting much lately, apart from, you know, our episodes here on Stacktrace, which I really, really love. But that's just because, you know, I'm really, really focusing now on just kind of the freelancing work, and I'm really enjoying it. Of course, that doesn't mean that I will never write an article again. I have many article ideas. I constantly build up a list of articles I want to write here. So I will definitely get to that hopefully soon. But just kind of from a focus perspective, it's been great to just focus on just writing a lot of code here during this last few months. And I mentioned earlier that I perhaps haven't been kind of just exploring new features from the new SDKs as much this time around, just because I've been mostly focusing on kind of building out features in existing apps. But of course, I have been exploring especially new Swift features, new Swift UI features, and so on. I've been updating my workshops to perhaps not be focused on iOS 17 specific features, because I want to make sure to teach people techniques and APIs that are really applicable for more operating system versions than just iOS 17. Because again, most people work on versions that are not just the latest one. But I always want to mention, kind of like, just keep it in your head that this particular workaround might not be needed in iOS 17 because here's this new API and so on and so forth. And also for myself to know kind of what's coming, right?
Right.
I think that's always something that's really good to do. Like, even if you can't adopt all of the latest and greatest stuff in your projects that you work on right now, kind of still looking into them and knowing what's coming up on the horizon is just good for planning and maintenance, because you can just like know that this thing is coming up like next year. So I might not need to build my own solution for this. I could kind of work around it in some way for now. And then next year I will just adopt the system API, for example, right?
Right.
So I've been focusing a lot on that. And also just making sure, like making compatibility fixes that you've been talking about as well, to make sure the apps work well on iOS 17 and on iPadOS 17 and so on. But I would say, like, lately, the last couple of operating system upgrades has been pretty smooth for me. And I say this even though I'm a pretty heavy user of Swift UI these days, which I know is something you and I talked about, like maybe 2 years ago or something. We were kind of a little bit fearful of how Swift UI would behave in terms of maintenance, because you give the system so much power in terms of how your views are rendered. And, you know, you just say, hey, give me a button. And then this Swift UI system kind of creates that button for you under the hood. And we were kind of worried about how would that work in terms of maintenance, because maybe some different things would subtly break across OS versions. And there's certainly been some of that, but I would say overall, I haven't had many of those issues. The issues I mostly face when it comes to Swift UI are things that are not working in, say, iOS 16, but they are fixed in iOS 17. So it feels like progress is being made, like more progress than regressions, which is really, really great. And there have been some compatibility things here and there that I've had to fix, but I would say pretty minor in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, it's interesting because you hear a lot in podcasts and whatnot, people talking about how awful Swift UI is and how it breaks with every minor OS update and how it's especially terrible on macOS. And I was always very confused because I've been using Swift UI on macOS for quite a while and never really had anything like that, like where a minor OS update just completely broke a layout or something. But when I started looking more into that and paying more attention, and especially after, I think it was a recent discussion on ATP where they talked about that, I figured that a lot of those reports from developers were of developers who were making a Catalyst app and using Swift UI. So then things were a lot more broken because that's two layers of abstraction, right? At least you have Swift UI to UIKit and then UIKit to running on macOS, which is Catalyst. And even worse, if you have like the make things look like macOS checkbox checked in Catalyst. So what I gather is that a lot of those experiences were because of people making a SwiftUI app for iOS, then checking the Catalyst box, and even worse if they checked the run as like a semi-native Mac app checkbox. Because I currently, the current betas of AirBuddy 3 go all the way back to macOS Big Sur, although I am planning on dropping that. And I often run, I have a separate Mac here, an Intel MacBook Escape, where I run operating systems from Big Sur to Ventura in order to test AirBuddy. And I often develop stuff, and of course I can't use APIs in SwiftUI that are not in Big Sur, if that particular view will run on Big Sur. And I don't test every single change that I make, but before every update, every beta, I do like a little QA session and run in every operating system. And I always have that feeling like, oh, something will break in macOS Big Sur or Monterey. And it's extremely rare for that to happen. So I don't know what the things people report about are and how terrible SwiftUI is on the Mac. I do understand that some Mac patterns are more difficult to do in SwiftUI, and SwiftUI doesn't do the right thing by default. But for custom UI, which is what I'm mostly focusing on with SwiftUI right now, I really haven't had any major issues.
Yeah, I think when you were talking there about like that a lot of people run into issues when combining SwiftUI with Catalyst, I think that's definitely like on the right track of uncovering this mystery. Why some people seem to really love SwiftUI and have no problems with it, and some people have a lot of problems with it, some people really don't like it, and it's like the opinions are kind of divisive, right? And some people, they start out loving it, and then over time, they get less and less enthusiastic about it. And yeah, for me, I would say like I've been in a little bit of all those camps, depending on which project I work on. For me, my experience working with SwiftUI has varied so much across different projects. Some projects have been almost like a clear win, where it's like I literally couldn't have built this app by myself or this client without SwiftUI, because it would just have taken too much time with UIKit. And I wouldn't have been able to do that within the budget that the client had, right?
Right.
So very often clients will come to me and say like, hey, we have this particular budget, can you help us? And sometimes I have to say, no, I'm sorry, like that won't be possible, even if I will work as quickly as I can, as efficiently as I can, which I always really, really try to do. And this is something I really focus on when it comes to my business, is like providing that very efficient service to my clients, like for them to get really good value out of the money that they spend hiring me. But still, like some things are just kind of impossible when it comes to like, we have this much budget and we want to achieve this. But with SwiftUI, I would say more and more of those things have become possible, where I know that, you know, I can build UIs much, much quicker, especially if the client doesn't have a lot of requirements when it comes to custom designs and so on. They mostly just want to get something out of the door that kind of, you know, connects to their backend and so on and so forth. Like that's something that has, SwiftUI has been a huge boost there for me personally and for the projects I work on. But then there are other projects where it's been not as successful, where it's actually been cases where SwiftUI has become really problematic when integrating it into kind of a larger legacy code base. And we've had to sometimes kind of rewrite things in UIKit or, you know, abandon that SwiftUI implementation, or sometimes kind of hack around different limitations in SwiftUI. So I can totally see all of those different perspectives, because I've had all those perspectives myself. Like some days I really love SwiftUI, some days I really want to go back to UIKit. So yeah, it really depends on which day you ask me. But like I mentioned, I think what you said there around like combining those technologies is kind of the key to solving the puzzle, because I've been thinking a lot about this, like how come I've had such varied experiences with SwiftUI. And I think it is when you combine too many technologies together, when your tech stack essentially becomes too complicated, that's when things start breaking down. Because it's very clear that SwiftUI is not just kind of syntactic sugar for UIKit. It's not like you create your SwiftUI views and then there's just UIKit under the hood. Because if it would be like that, then the Catalyst situation would just work out of the box, right? Because your SwiftUI views would just be UIKit views, all of them under the hood, and they would all work the same way as your other Catalyst UIKit views. But that's not the case. So, you know, it is really more complicated than when it first might seem like. And The same thing I would say is true if you start like really integrating with the SwiftUI navigation system or, you know, different toolbars and built-in system controls, and list is something we've talked about. It's a really kind of love-hate relationship that I have to the list component because of the same reasons. It has like that more complex technology stack. It has to integrate with UI collection view and UI scroll view under the hood. And sometimes those connections break and so on. So one thing I've learned is that unfortunately, like I feel like Apple, they've kind of put themselves and us in a situation where they have too many technologies and they have too of a broad or deep, like complex matrix of technologies. And the combinations that we can achieve with those is really cool that we can use SwiftUI with Catalyst and run our UIKit code on the Mac. Like, but when we start combining things like that, like it really becomes really complex. And that's when so many bugs will start to surface. And this is where I've kind of settled on with SwiftUI is that I don't want to try to integrate it in too complex of an environment because it just will probably break down. I want to kind of keep to the mainstream path. And on one hand, it's really sad that you have to think about that because ideally, all of the different technologies and APIs and SDKs that Apple provides us with should just work, right? That's right. Kind of the tagline, right? It just works. But it doesn't just work, unfortunately. And we have to be a little bit more careful these days, which, again, is too bad. But it's the reality we're in where we have a lot of options, but not all of those options are good options.
Yeah, and I feel like it was last year, right, at DubDub where they said, like, the future is SwiftUI or something like that. It was last year, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I feel like that message was kind of an attempt to direct people to, hey, come over here. And it's funny that you mentioned SwiftUI as syntactic sugar for UIKit. And in Vision OS this year, SwiftUI is, if for iOS it would be the sugar, in Vision OS, SwiftUI would be like the flower or something, because it's actually powering UIKit in some places. And I know that on macOS as well, there are now AppKit controls that are implemented in SwiftUI under the hood, which is kind of interesting to think about how the technologies are kind of getting inverted in some way. So I think you're right about the complex matrix. And I wonder if also a lot of the perception I was talking about is from people developing for a platform they're not familiar with for the first time because SwiftUI makes that easier. And I feel like that because when I'm using SwiftUI to make apps for iOS, I feel a bit like what people describe using SwiftUI for macOS is like. So I feel like I don't know what I'm doing and things just don't work as I expected them to and things like that. But I wonder if that's just because I am less familiar with iOS and more familiar with macOS, because I say a lot about all the SwiftUI code I'm writing for AirBuddy and things like that, but behind a lot of that SwiftUI code is also a lot of AppKit I wrote myself, because SwiftUI on the Mac didn't provide the thing that I wanted. And we've talked at length before how some people view that as a failure of SwiftUI, and in my view, it's quite the opposite. It's amazing that I can write a lot of this boilerplate, complex AppKit code, but wrap it in like a view modifier. And when I'm using it, it's just like I'm using SwiftUI, but it happens to be a little piece of SwiftUI that I've implemented myself. So I think maybe a lot of that perception is, oh, SwiftUI works on the Mac as well. Maybe I'll add macOS as a target and build and run. And oh my God, this doesn't look good. and then that perception surfaces.
Yeah, I think, like, again, the environment that you use SwiftUI in matters so incredibly much, right? Yeah. And that influences so much, I think, your experience of the framework itself. And I think that's another component that you just mentioned is, like, you know, when you are super familiar with macOS and you are comfortable doing all those workarounds, you know how to achieve something with AppKit, you can more easily make those workarounds because, like you mentioned, you can create a view modifier or a custom view. You can use NSView or NSView controller representable. You can then, you know, all of AppKit is at your disposal at that point. You know, you can just have fun with it, right?
Yep.
And that creates a better experience because there hasn't been a single SwiftUI project I worked on where I haven't had to make a single workaround. Like, I make workarounds all the time. And again, it can be a criticism against the framework, like that the framework is incomplete or it's buggy or, you know, we wish things would be better. But on the other hand, like I mentioned earlier, some projects that I work on haven't really been possible without SwiftUI. So you get some and you lose some, right? Like, it's always, again, that trade-off, right?
Yep.
It's just a question of the environment you're working in, whether it's based on your experience of the platform, the complexity of the code base you're deploying SwiftUI in, if you're using a complex technology stack already with Catalyst and SwiftUI combination, what your app does, what kind of architectural pattern you're using, if you're using Cordata or not. So, like, all of those things kind of influence, I feel like, your experience of SwiftUI. And again, it's really unfortunate that it is like this, because ideally, SwiftUI should have just been this big win for Apple, right? They introduce it, right. It's just working great. It doesn't matter where you're using it. It's all cross-platform. You know, the pitch, right? The pitch for SwiftUI, that's what we want from it. And that's, I feel like, why the disappointment also becomes even stronger, because in the beginning, when you start using it and you're deploying it in a project, it can feel so incredibly nice, because you get this boost in productivity. You can define your reviews so nicely. You can use previews. But then, like, you can run into these issues. And yeah, depending on the environment, again, it can either be easy to fix them or it can be incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I don't even like calling this sort of thing a workaround, as you mentioned. Sometimes what I would call a workaround is if there is something in SwiftUI that could do the thing you want, but it's just not working as it should, that I would consider a workaround when you fall back to UIKit or AppKit. Or if you're doing, like, the more hacky reaching into the view hierarchy underlying the SwiftUI views and things like that, that is definitely a workaround, and even more than a workaround, it's a hack, basically.
That's a hack for sure. Those things I don't do.
Yeah. So I don't even consider that a workaround. It's just me implementing a thing that SwiftUI is not providing at that moment. And actually, I am going to plug here. I've been working with Ben Sherman from NS Screencast. We've been doing the series on a Mac app that we've been working on for the series. And we've been recording the later episodes, so towards the end of the series, and we are doing a little image gallery thing where you click an image and it opens in a new window and has, like, window animations and things like that. And there's a lot of AppKit involved. But the end result is actually really nice, and the code is not terrible at all. It's actually quite nice. And one thing we mentioned, I think, multiple times during the series is how a lot of this stuff is stuff you write once. Like, there's a bunch of AppKit stuff and view modifiers and whatnot, but you write that stuff once and you have it. And now SwiftUI has that feature for you because you've implemented it. And you can just use it in your projects. And I think that's a really nice feature of SwiftUI. And of course, it's not exclusive to SwiftUI, but you get all the benefits of SwiftUI, the declarative API and things like that. But you can get that for your own stuff that you implemented under the hood that, yeah, is a bit of work in the beginning to get the thing implemented and working. But once you have it and you have a nice SwiftUI API on top of it, that's it. You have that feature now in SwiftUI.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree, like, when you approach it that way and when you're mixing technologies like that, I also wouldn't consider that workarounds, and I don't consider that a bad thing either. Like, those are just great. Like, when you can leverage both frameworks to use what they're best for, like, fantastic. That's awesome. What I'm talking about here and what I think, like, is the source of the frustration that people feel is when there are literally workarounds, right? When something is not working, or something is buggy, or it's glitchy, or it doesn't actually behave as you would expect, or you implement the same thing in UIKit or the same thing in SwiftUI, and they're different in some way, and you want that consistency because you don't want one screen to feel different than another screen in your app, right? That's when the frustration kicks in, not when you, like, deliberately implement something using the other technology. Like, that's awesome. I do that all the time too. And that is not frustrating, at least not for me. Like, I agree with you there. Like, you build up this library of things and you implement certain things with UIKit or AppKit and other things with SwiftUI, and you mix them together, and that's fantastic. But it's like when you when you're forced to do that mixing or when you're forced to kind of like access something you're not maybe supposed to architecturally, like for example, the only way to present this alert would be to say UI application, shared application, root view controller present alert. Like that doesn't feel great, right? Yeah. Because you tried to use the dot alert modifier in SwiftUI, but it wasn't working for some reason, right? Like that's when you get frustrated.
Yeah, I've been torturing SwiftUI on the Mac for a while now, and I think my favorite example, I don't think it's in any current version of AirBuddy, it will be in a future beta, but I have a place in the app where I have a video playing, so I have an AV player layer somewhere, but it's in SwiftUI, and I've made it work with matched geometry effect. So that the whole video can be in a matched geometry effect and it will transition from one view to another and keep the current playhead position in the video. So when I wrote that, I thought there's no way this is going to work, but it did. And I, of course, had to do a lot of coding to get that to work correctly, but it did work, and it's not like a huge pile of hacks. It's actually fairly well structured and abstracted code. So I think that's one example where I was feeling like I was torturing SwiftUI to an extent where it wouldn't be able to deliver, but it did.
Right. And I feel like that's another one of those kind of expectation things that I feel Apple has kind of painted themselves into a corner a little bit here, where they're kind of, again, pitching SwiftUI when you look at the WWC sessions and so on, and the comments by Apple and so on regarding the framework is very much around that it's, you know, so easy, so simple. Look at this. It's so compact, the code. Here's what you used to have to write in UIKit, and here's what you write in SwiftUI. And I feel like it kind of creates this expectation from developers, and we've had those expectations too, I'm sure, many times, that things will be simple because that's what they told us, right?
Yeah.
And then when they're not, you kind of feel, again, disappointed, or you feel like you're doing a workaround or a hack. And a concrete example of that would be when you use the onChangeOf modifier. Like, ideally, like, if you look at, like, how the state management system works and so on, like, you should be able to just, like, bind your state to your view, like, have the state modifiers and observable objects and so on, and it should all just work. You shouldn't need to, like, do any manual state management with SwiftUI. But for various reasons, sometimes you do. Like, when you're working in different projects, maybe you have objects that you can't observe directly, or you can't really inject them directly into your view, or they're not available at that time, or for various reasons, you might need to do some manual state observation. And then you might need to do like dot on change of, pass in a value, and then you get a closure whenever that value changes and you can react to it. For example, by changing your view state and then your view refreshes, right?
Right.
That might, when you implement something like that, feel like, oh, I'm creating such a hack or such a workaround. But it's like one little piece of state management that you had to write compared to in UIKit where you had to write all the state management yourself, right? So it's still a big win. And I think that's something that it's like a little bit of an expectation recalibration that I've had to do personally to say, I'm not going into this expecting that everything will be handled by the system. I'm expecting that some things will, but I'm also expecting that a lot of things I still have to implement myself. And I feel like if you kind of approach it that way, again, it's kind of, it's a shame that you have to think that way. It would be so awesome if you could not have to do any of that, right? Like the framework would just work as pitched or as like intended. But since we still do have to do some of those things, I think having that expectation going into a new feature or new project makes it nicer to use.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we are developers after all, so we should probably have to write some code unless AI replaces us or something.
Oh, let's not go there today. But I do have another topic I want to talk about around this. We won't have time for it on this episode, but let's save it maybe for the next one. And that's regarding kind of open versus closed API design. And I feel like this is another area where SwiftUI causes frustration, where since it's very closed compared to something like UIKit or AppKit, that can also lead to a lot of frustration. But I think that's something we can discuss maybe on next episode or the episode after. So a little cliffhanger there for the audience.
Nice.
So another thing that I've been up to lately has actually little to do with code. I have been doing some kind of tweaking and, you know, scripting and things like that regarding this thing, but not so much coding on it. And that's that I've actually bought another new computer, Rambo.
Ooh.
Can you believe it? And can you believe it that it's another Windows computer?
Oh, God, so now, no. You're becoming a PC person.
Right, like now I have two actively used Windows computers here in my house and two actively used Macs. So they're on even ground now, Rambo. Soon, who knows, maybe there will be a third Windows PC and they're going to take over here.
Ooh.
What do you think about that?
Well, you probably also have iOS devices and things like that, so I guess that also counts.
True, but I also have Xbox, you know, Windows-based kind of, so. to not cause any panic here, I'm not switching to Windows or anything like that. I'm still very much a Mac person when it comes to work, but as our listeners might know, is that I've gotten really into PC gaming lately, since like a year or so ago. And I built my own gaming PC like last fall, and that was a lot of fun to put all of that together and to build my own computer. And we talked about this on the show as well with Sundell Silicon, which was a really fun episode. That's been working great, by the way. I've been iterating on that. I've been also tweaking that continuously and built my own kind of little front end for all my games. So when I launched a PC now, it's like all in a very console-like experience. So I've been really enjoying that. But the new PC that I got is actually a handheld PC. So this is something that's become a little bit more popular lately. I would say ever since the Nintendo Switch launched, it started this really big trend of that kind of Switch-like form factor that, you know, you have a controller and a screen and it's not a tablet. It's not like a classic handle, like a Game Boy or something, which was way more compact, but more like a hybrid where you have a bigger screen and you then have controls on the side so you can actually game on the thing. And now in the PC world lately, there has been a bunch of products coming out that kind of follow that same form factor, but they're actually PCs. And one that you might have heard of, Rambo, is the Steam Deck. Have you heard about this product?
Yes, I have.
And that is a kind of a middle ground, I would say, between kind of a full Windows-based PC. It's not actually a Windows-based computer at all, but it is a PC. But it's running a custom version of Linux that Valve developed for Steam. And they have a really interesting kind of technology set up there where they are essentially like running Windows-based games, but translating them into Linux using a layer called Proton. And this is also related to what Apple is now doing, actually, with the game porting toolkit that listeners might have heard about, that now you can also, using that game porting toolkit that Apple provided at WWDC, you can translate DirectX draw calls and Windows game APIs into macOS and actually run Windows games on your Mac. Which is pretty cool. Of course, the performance is not perhaps, you know, that great, especially when it comes to more demanding games, but still very interesting to see. When it comes to what Valve has been doing with the Steam Deck, it's definitely way more further ahead than what Apple is doing, and that has been working out really, really well. But that's not the device I bought. So I bought a device called the Asus ROG Ally, which is a little bit of a mouthful, the name. But it's a really interesting device because it is very much like a Switch or a Steam Deck. It's a little bit bigger than a Nintendo Switch, but it runs Windows. So it's an actual Windows PC. And this comes with a lot of pros and cons. We can start with some of the cons first. And that is that when you boot up this device, it's kind of funny, but because it's kind of the opposite of when you buy an Apple product. So when you buy an Apple product, you open it up, right? You open up the box, you turn on the thing, and you have this beautiful onboarding experience. It walks you through setting the whole thing up. And you're done, you're into your iPhone, you're into your Mac, and you can just use it, right?
Yeah.
The ROG Ally, when you boot it up for the first time, it just runs the Windows installation process.
Oh.
So it doesn't have any like, you know, welcome to this device, here's how you can configure this device. It's more like, okay, now you can install Windows, good luck.
Enter your license key.
Exactly. I mean, that actually they did have already pre-configured, so it's cool. And they did they also have like a layer configured already for specifically for handheld gaming called Armory Crate, where you have all your games there and you can configure, you know, different game settings and so on. So they have done some work to kind of make it more game friendly, but it was just really funny when you kind of booted it up and it's like, welcome to Windows. Okay, great. Let's get started. Do I want to sync my phone to this? Do I want to set up a cloud drive? And it's like, no, I just want a game on this thing.
Right.
So it definitely took quite a while to actually get it set up and up and running for gaming, which is, I would say, one of the major downsides of this device is that it's kind of the opposite of plug and play, right? You get this device, you have to configure it, you have to set up everything you want, you have to set up your different launchers and your Steam and your different maybe scripts and tools that you want to use and your drivers you have to download, and all of those things that comes with actually a Windows-based PC as a desktop also come with this device. So it's definitely not something for someone who's looking for like a Nintendo Switch-like experience. It's something more, you know, similar to just a standard Windows-based PC. But the upsides then, there's a lot of upsides to this. And the fact that it runs full Windows, and it's also a quite capable system when it comes to the hardware, it's running the latest AMD Z1 chip, which is like AMD's kind of system on a chip, similar to Apple's system on a chip, but you know, from AMD, and it has really good graphics and CPU capabilities. So it's a really, really fast device. It can run Windows games natively. So you can run all sorts of games, and you can use all sorts of game services like Steam and Epic Game Store and Xbox Game Pass. It's all there. And it performs really well. Like, I'm getting really great graphics on this thing, really great frame rates. And it's been really, really fun to kind of just tinker and set it up and configure it the way I wanted to. Definitely not something that I would recommend to anyone who is not kind of into that kind of tinkering PC gaming mindset. It's definitely a product for people like that, like me. But I've had a lot of fun with it, and I've been really, really enjoying configuring it and playing games on it.
Yeah, nice. You mentioned the onboarding experience, but actually I was thinking that the iOS onboarding experience for when you get like a brand new device and you don't do like the direct transfer from another device, it is actually quite lengthy when you look at it. So it is nice, of course. It has like it's polished and all of that, but it's not that quick, actually.
Yeah, but it still feels like, you know, relevant to what you're doing. Like, when you're setting up Windows on this device, it's asking if you want to sync your Office 365 account. And it's like, I'm not going to edit Word documents on this thing, right? And I mean, to be fair, like, you can definitely use this. It has a USB-C port. You can plug it into your display. You can plug in a mouse and keyboard. And you can actually use it as a computer, right? Because it is a computer.
Right.
So you can use it to do work if you want to. You can use it for Word documents. But I think that most of the people who buy this device are not going to use a device that has like joysticks on both sides and you know, clearly a game machine using it for kind of office work. I think that would be almost a little bit absurd.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, like I mentioned, I've been having a really, really great fun with it. And the hardware is really just amazing. Like, the screen is fantastic. It's a 1080p screen with 120 hertz support, which, you know, Rambo, you know me, I love my hertzes. So the more hertz, the better. And 120 hertz, fantastic. It has VRR, so you get really smooth, like, between different frame rates, it really interpolates really smoothly. You've got amazing audio. I would say definitely one of the best implementations of spatial audio that I've heard. And I own AirPods, right? Mm-hmm. I have a MacBook Pro, and this is definitely on par with that, which I didn't expect. So that's been really great. Like I mentioned, also the performance has been fantastic. The fact that I can run all the different games that I want to play on this because it runs Windows has also been really, really nice. So overall, I'm very, very happy with it. The two major downsides, I would say, are one, the fact that it is a PC, so you do have to make all of that configuration and things that are involved with that and keep everything up to date with all the drivers and things like that. The software experience is also slightly janky because of that, because everything is kind of built on top of Windows. So Windows is still there, right? So
right.
You sometimes, like, see, you know, you might be running that overlay, that game overlay I mentioned, and you get like that kind of nice console-like experience, but then all of a sudden you're back on the desktop, right? And
right.
You're like back into Windows again. So yeah, that can definitely happen. And then the second downside is, I would say, the battery life, where it does have a quite sizable battery in it, and it does support USB-C fast charging. It even comes with a 65-watt charger, which charges up the device really quickly. But if you're running, like, you know, really demanding games on this and really pushing the hardware and running with high frame rates and high graphics settings at 1080p, then you're going to burn through that battery life in 1 to 2 hours, I would say. So not as good battery life as something like the Nintendo Switch, but also you get a lot more power. So that's, again, kind of a trade-off like we like to talk about.
Yeah, that's the Switch definitely has trade-offs in order to achieve that battery life. However, it's still the one that I have because it's for people who are more like me, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are the right trade-offs Nintendo have made for their customers, right?
Yeah.
Like, you would never want a Nintendo product where the first thing you have to do is install a bunch of drivers and, and, you know, worry about... Another thing you can do with this device, by the way, is you can decide how much power to give to the CPU and GPU. You can decide, like, how many watts do I want to give to the system on a chip? Because based on that, the CPU and GPU will run at different clock speeds, which you can, by the way, also control. You can also control the fan curves. You can control all sorts of things. Like, that would not have been appropriate for a Nintendo product. Like, imagine, like, all sorts of, like, you know, families buying a Nintendo system for their family, and then they have to configure fan curves. Like, that would just be crazy, right?
And then they overclock it and it explodes or something.
Exactly. It would be terrible. So, yeah, I said, like, this device is definitely not for everyone, but for me, it's amazing. Like, I really, really love it. And, you know, anyone else who's, like, a... you know, enthusiasts when it comes to these things and like kind of tinkering around with things. This is a really, really nice handheld. So I've been having a lot of fun with it.
Nice.
All right. But I think this will be the end of this episode of Stack Trace. So thanks so much for listening, everybody, to this 200th episode of the show. So all that remains really is for us to say goodbye. And that will be you that will do that, Rambo. So please say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
For the 200th time, goodbye.